the more you'll believe it can be attained, and the more you're likely to act. Take action every day towards your desired outcome. Accept that there will be setbacks. Close your eyes and imagine how you'll deal with those setbacks as they come and continue forward towards your goal. Expand your knowledge. If more knowledge is required, research, talk to experts, take a class. Use the knowledge to further detail your vision statement and the steps that you'll take to get there. Make time to consider your visualization. Visualize twice daily for a total of 10 minutes. It's most effective in the moments when you wake and the moments right before you go to sleep. This will help engage the subconscious in your focused effort towards your desired outcome. Close your eyes and imagine the desired outcome with all related senses and all emotions. Write your desired outcome as if it's true in the present day on an index card. Read it in the morning and at night. Create a vision board and have it in your line of sight. See it when you go to bed at night. Here are some more techniques and tools you can use to learn how to practice visualization successfully. Create a vision board. This visualization tool is a collection of images and words that inspire you and represent your goals. It serves as a visual representation of what you want to achieve. Place your board somewhere you'll see it every day. That way, you'll be consistently reminded of what you're working towards. Try out some of these visualization techniques. Your selective attention will be directed toward fulfilling your vision. You'll be the thermostat creating the condition that's right for you. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, spend some time with yourself as you check in on what's important to you and why. Big or small, set a path for yourself that includes the steps to get there. Check in regularly and lean on support when you need extra motivation to keep going. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I can lean on. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Oregon coast. I'm your host, Dina Pavlis. I'm pleased to be in the studio today with Jackie Lindsay. Jackie is the science coordinator for the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, a citizen science project housed at the University of Washington that focuses on the beach environment along our Pacific coast. We'll be talking about their beached bird program and how you can get involved as a citizen scientist that can help inform about the health and well-being of our seabird population. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here. Can you share a bit about the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, which we will refer to as COAST for the remainder of this show, and your role with COAST?
Yeah, absolutely. We are a citizen science program, which means that we are really a large community of folks all working together to collect data, to monitor beaches, and collect really interesting stories that can talk about our marine ecosystem just by monitoring the beaches that we all love to walk anyway. So that's really the goal of the COAST program, is to monitor beaches with the help of community members who are not necessarily, in fact, we prefer that they are not necessarily trained scientists, and they submit data into our central hub, and one of my roles as science coordinator, go about pulling together those data stories, sharing them with folks who manage natural resources or care about natural resources, and making sure that we share those stories back to our citizen scientists as well.
That is so interesting. And I have lots of questions about what you just said. And so I think I'll start with just how can people get involved with COAST? You mentioned that you prefer, you know, just having, I don't know what you'd call them, but non-scientists maybe. But how
Non-traditional scientists
or amateur scientists, how can people get involved with COAST and begin reporting information?
We love to have folks get involved with our program directly. And what that means is getting out, getting a beach assigned to them, and then walking that beach to report back into us. And the way to really get involved is to come to one of our training events and learn a little bit about what you would be doing. And then once you hear our whole story, all of the procedures that you'll go through when you go out to the beach, signing up for a particular beach that is really near you, that you care about, that you want to walk on a regular basis. And by regular, I mean once a month. You don't have to go out there every day or every week. We know folks have other things going on in their lives as well.
Yeah. Do you offer training for people who want to get involved?
Yeah, we do. So the trainings that we hold are both online and in person. And if you can get to one of the in-person trainings before you start up your beach survey, that's fantastic. But those trainings are about 5 hours where we talk to you about the program, where we talk to you a little bit about how to monitor a beach and how to report on any beach cast birds that you may find. And then at the end of that training, you're all ready to go out and get your very own beach assigned to you for monthly surveys.
Do you have any training coming up?
We do, and anyone who's really curious about getting to one right now can go to our website and check out our trainings and events calendar. But we are going to be in December in Port Orford and Brookings doing in-person trainings, and they'll also actually be a presentation where you can go to a brewery and hear a little bit about our program and our research before you even decide to come out to one of our trainings, and that'll be in Brookings in early December as well.
Okay, great. So I'm curious if the beached bird program involves only deceased birds, or are live beached birds also included in the surveying?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are really only looking for reports on dead birds. So beached in this case is our euphemism for dead bird survey. And the reason for that is it seems crazy, and I understand that, but it's really a cool way to be able to get to know a bird up close and personal. And you may not want to get all that close with your face into a dead bird, but when you can actually approach a bird that's sitting still on the beach, you have this really unique opportunity to be able to identify it yourself using tools that we give you as part of our program, a beached bird guide that's specifically for this purpose. But you can go and you can take measurements and you can take photos and you can flip the bird over to see its plumage on the backside. And all of those things, if any birders are listening, they know they're a lot different than when you're observing live birds and trying to make an ID on the fly, so to speak, where you have really only a couple of seconds, maybe in low light, maybe you're identifying them by a call. And all of those things require a lot of split second decisions that are really for experts in some cases. And what we want to do is make our data science accessible to anyone. So when you see a dead bird on the beach, doesn't matter who you are, you can go identify that bird and report it into us without having any natural history training or background in identifying birds.
That's so interesting. I think I will never look at a dead bird the same again. You know, when I see one, seriously, because as somebody who enjoys bird watching, my biggest frustration with bird watching is I'm not an expert, and it's so hard for me to identify a bird in just a few seconds. And of course, I didn't think about that, but with a dead bird, it's not moving. So I'm curious about what people are actually reporting to you. For example, let's say I find a bird carcass on the beach. What happens next?
What happens next is you will kneel down on the sand. You'll take a closer look at that bird, and you'll go through a series of steps to measure different body parts and then use those measurements as well as some of the colors and the shape of the foot to work through our guide and identify that bird to species. You'll write all of that down. You'll take a couple of photos of your bird, and then you'll send all that information into COAST, where we actually take a look at those same pieces of data that you collected, and we're able to double check. We're able to do a second identification process. And if we both agree, we are very confident that we have a particular species of bird. And this is all very important to us because we don't just want to know that there was a dead bird on your beach at some point. We want to know how recently that bird arrived, how fresh it was. We also want to know what species it was so that we can track different patterns in the mortality of these seabirds by just observing what washes in on your beach and on the beaches of 400 other participants across the lower 48, for example. So we have these really intricate patterns in the species that wash in, the condition of those carcasses, and then where and when they wash in to be able to tell stories about the ecosystem itself changing.
I have so many questions about the data that you collect, but before I do that, I'm curious if you track all kinds of birds, or are you only interested in data for particular species?
We do track all kinds of birds, and because we have folks surveyed their beaches instead of their local neighborhood pond or forest, we are focusing on seabirds, so birds that spend at least some part of their lives in the marine environment. Now, we do occasionally have folks report in raptors or owls or chickens or some birds that are way out of range that we wouldn't expect to see on the beaches of the Pacific Northwest, for example. One time we saw a purple gallinule, which had come all the way up from the Gulf and got very, very lost before ending up on a Washington beach. But we record data about all the birds that end up on the beach, regardless of their species. And we get really detailed about the species that are actually seabirds on the beach, because those are the ones who we think are impacted and are sort of monitoring the ocean itself before they wash in. When they're out in the ocean, either doing very well or starving or getting sick, washing on the beach is like a report to us. They're reporting in on the state of the ocean's health by just washing up on our beach and showing us how they lived a little bit.
Well, that's interesting, and it's a great segue into my next question. I'm guessing that the types of species that you see would vary quite a bit during the year, since many of our seabirds are migratory, but I'm wondering if there are other factors that might cause data to fluctuate during times of the year.
There are quite a few factors, and we sort of have to keep those in the back of our mind when we're looking at our data set, but one of those is just something that you mentioned, that some birds are in our local nearshore marine ecosystem, for example, to breed in the summertime. And when we find them here, we see them flying around more often. We also see them washing up on our beaches more often during that time period. And it's sort of a combination of their location and also what they're doing that makes those birds die in a place where they actually would wash up on our beaches and we would see them rather than them simply sinking to the bottom of the ocean before getting a chance to wash up on beach and report in about the state of their ecosystem. So for example, we have some birds called common murres who breed on rocky cliffs on small islands just offshore. And when they are breeding on the Oregon coastline, they are doing two things. They're right next to shore and they are doing a really stressful thing. They're raising chicks. Any parents will tell you that this is the time where your resources are tapped to the max. So birds are doing something very stressful and they're doing it right near shore. So during that time of year, we tend to see more of those birds and eventually their chicks as well washing in on our beaches. And when we see that, it's actually a sign that maybe there is a really active breeding season going on. So we can see birds washing in on our coastline as a good thing. It's a sign of success. They've all returned to the breeding colonies and they're attempting a breeding season, which is good news for their populations.
That's so interesting. I would never have thought that seeing more of a particular species would be a good sign. And that really makes me wonder, what are you learning from the data that's being submitted?
We are learning things about both sort of natural history stories, like the one I just told about the timing and breeding success of certain species. But also, we are establishing a baseline where we know what's sort of supposed to happen in, say, a good year where all the birds are doing happy breeding things during one time of year and foraging offshore during another time of year. But we are able to compare that baseline story to some weird year where we suddenly stop seeing birds showing up at a time where we would expect them to be showing up, or we see hundreds of birds showing up in an area where we usually only see 2 or 10 birds showing up in a given month. So we track that encounter rate that our participants are tracking every time they go out to the beach, and we're able to track chronic issues or things like a marine heat wave happening offshore that might be impacting the birds in a different way this year than it is in any other year. So we're learning about the major factors in the ecosystem that stress out some of our top predators, like seabirds, so we can detect changes that are going on in the ecosystem as a whole, as well as for the bird species in particular that are being affected at any one time. Some people use this information to help inform fishery management decisions or to help inform some of the information that they collected or didn't collect on a seabird colony when they went out to check on their seabird research in the summertime and didn't see very many birds around. Our data sort of helps to set a baseline to compare against whenever you see something strange.
Interesting. And I'm wondering, is any of the data used to help develop public messaging?
Yeah, in some cases, we're actually working towards that a little bit ourselves. So we are able to, by looking at the trends and comparing anomalies to that baseline, we're able to tease out sort of a CSI, why did the birds die, story. And when we are able to present that story, not just to the academic community or to research managers, but also back to our participants, they end up being ambassadors because they are now out on the beaches. They know the story of what birds normally wash in just because they walk their beaches so often in some cases, but they also know the story of why last summer there were so many birds on the beach, and they end up having casual conversations with folks who are simply interested in the marine environment. They show up at the beach for that reason, and spreading actual really intense scientific information in a very casual way. And those presentations of information are just hundreds of very small conversations in lots and lots of cases. And we give some of those community science presentations when we're invited as well, as we will be doing in Brookings on December 10th. We'll be having one of those conversations, inviting folks to come, learn a little bit, and ask us questions about their marine ecosystem on a very local scale.
I think that's great. And sometimes it's, like you say, it's hundreds or thousands of small conversations have a huge impact versus a one-time large hit of information. Because sometimes people
exactly.
need to hear things over and over as well to digest all of it, right? Because it's just a lot of information.
And if you don't have a chance to ask questions after you hear information, you can write it right off. All right, I heard that story, but I wasn't engaged. I didn't get to see any part of that apply to me.
Exactly. And that's really important, too. How does this apply to me, right? And I don't mean that from a selfish perspective, but if it applies to people where they live in their own daily life, they're more apt to get involved or want to make a change if a change is necessary.
Yeah. And when people are walking the beach, it's amazing what happens. They become experts. They become local experts on their beach and what washes in, not just in the seabirds that wash in, but also in sort of the marine debris, the trash that they see washing in, or the marine mammal that strands, and they find out who to call and how to engage a new organization. And there are actually lots of fantastic programs along the Oregon coastline that do a lot of these different things, and people get inspired, they get more and more involved, and they become exactly that. They become local experts in lots of different ways. And those local experts are the ones who can show up to a community meeting and help to make decisions about what their local commission should do next to help protect this environment that they care about or this part of their life that they care about.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that we have had a lot of those organizations on the show, and so people can go to our playlist on SoundCloud.com. Just go to SoundCloud, search for Beyond Your Front Door Oregon, and look for The Wave. And you can find those shows there. We recently had Jim Rice from the Marine Mammal Stranding Network on, and we had Saul. It's a lot of great information. And so it's good for people to be aware of those if they are out walking the beach. I am curious if the avian flu has impacted the number of dead birds you are seeing on the beach, or if that doesn't really impact seabirds.
That's a great and very, very topical question. We have this highly pathogenic avian influenza that is circulating in bird communities across the nation. And what we have seen on our local shorelines is that there doesn't seem to have been a really large bump in mortality, particularly over this last summer months when a lot of the birds were congregating in close quarters and could have been spreading disease. we didn't see a bunch of those birds suddenly dying off and washing up on our beaches, which is what we might have expected if they were all passing that disease back and forth. That's not to say none of them have been infected, and we know from testing, and there's a great map on the USGS website that shows where different seabirds as well as marine mammals have tested positive with avian influenza pathogen in their system. But it doesn't seem like we've seen a really huge bump yet in mortality directly associated with those occasional positive tests. So we're a little bit hopeful that at least this last season, our seabirds on our shore made it by without having too much of an impact. But we do know from colonies on the Atlantic side of our country, as well as in England and Scotland, that seabirds absolutely can be infected by this disease and can pass it back and forth relatively quickly, having huge impacts on colony breeders, like gannets, for example. So we haven't seen it yet here, but we have sort of stood prepared to start collecting that data and engage folks to do that testing if we did see really high rates of mortality for a reason that we couldn't quite pin down, except must be avian influenza.
Well, I'm going to hope that it doesn't happen. And
same here.
I did notice on your website that you are looking for volunteers in Alaska, and I'm wondering, are you doing a different type of work there, or is it the same work that people are doing here?
It is. It's the same kind of program that we do down here. The only major difference in Alaska is that sometimes your beach is just entirely covered in snow for a few months of the year, so you don't necessarily get out on your beach bird survey for a couple of months. But otherwise, yes, we were collecting the same stories, and sometimes we've actually seen mortality events down here in our marine ecosystem that have sort of had a cascade all the way up to Alaskan waters as well. So we have multiple marine ecosystems that we can detect changes in and tie all of those stories together at the same time for those birds that occupy both regions. And there's quite a few. Seabirds are travelers.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't think about the fact that snow would, you know, of course, we don't really get snow on the beach here, maybe like once in a blue moon, and it melts pretty quickly the same day. So, yeah, that would be really different to not be able to have access to that area.
And sometimes the sea is frozen as well if you're in the really northern region. So there's some different weather going on, but some of the same patterns, and certainly the same kind of concerned citizens in Alaskan waters, including some folks who actually use seabirds for local indigenous subsistence harvest, which isn't something that we think about really down here when we look at seabirds, but seabirds have been a large part of some indigenous populations in Alaska since time immemorial. They've lived for a very long time using these seabirds, not just as ecosystem indicators, but also as resources. So there are especially concerned citizens in Alaska when they see seabirds struggling and having difficulty in washing up dead in large numbers. So there's another unique perspective for a lot of our work in Alaska.
Yeah, that's really important. Thank you for sharing that. Well, Jackie, one of my favorite parts of this show is asking people to share a favorite memory or experience. And I'm wondering if you have a favorite memory related to your work with Coast that you would like to share.
Wow, so many. I've been with the Coast program for about 5 years, and I was lucky enough to be able to work with some citizen scientists doing seabird monitoring in California when I was in grad school prior to working with Coast as well. So those things that stand out to me in that process, I think they're really highlights from my time as a trainer, when I actually get to travel to communities and work with community members who are specifically interested in what we're doing, and they have these sort of aha moments when they're either telling me about their beach and what they've seen there over the last few years, or when they're seeing and measuring and looking at a seabird for the first time. And we travel with our own collection of seabird parts to be able to train folks to actually do this work on the beach. So when the first time you look at a seabird foot and you're a birder, so you're used to trying to identify a bird, but you look at that foot and you notice that there's a certain arrangement of the toes that's unique to this whole family of birds that you've been looking at, but you've never looked at their feet because it's not the first thing you do when you're a live birder. And they have sort of an aha moment where they tie the story of how the bird lives to what their feet look like to this family group that are all related, and the process of ID. That's one of the cooler things for me, when folks really get to get hands-on and learn something cool and new right in front of me, just because we're able to discuss this topic in great detail. And it's a lot of fun to see people learn.
That's so exciting. You know, I have a friend who is an amazing bird photographer in California. His name is Jay Spring, and you can find his work online. He's really great. And I love when I see his close-up photos because, yeah, you're exactly right. I notice things that, you know, I would never notice when I'm out birding and I've only had a few seconds to look at a bird. And I think, oh, I never noticed that bird, you know, had a beak or a bill that looked like that, or I never noticed it, you know, exactly, its feet were like that, or the colors were really so much more complex. And so that's exciting. That's a great, great story. Well, Jackie, I'm going to take a moment to let listeners know, if you tuned in late, you've been listening to Beyond Your Front Door, produced for the Pacifica Radio Network in the studios of KXCR here in beautiful downtown Florence, Oregon. I've been speaking with Jackie Lindsay. Jackie is the science coordinator at the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, a citizen science project housed at the University of Washington that focuses on the beach environment along our Pacific coast. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on SoundCloud.com. Just search SoundCloud for Beyond Your Front Door and look for The Wave. Jackie, I'm wondering if you can share again the upcoming training sessions and events that you have in December?
Yeah, absolutely. If folks are interested in coming out and talking to us and doing a training in person to get more involved in this kind of work, we have trainings taking place on the weekend of the 10th and 11th in December, and those will be taking place in Port Orford and Brookings. And you can go visit our website, coastwith2s.org, to check out those things under the Join Our Team section. And you can also shoot us an email if you're interested in joining us but can't make it to those events. You can send us a message at, again, coastwith2s@uw.edu. We're based at the University of Washington. And those kinds of events are recurring locally. We try to get out every 6 months to the central and southern Oregon coast as much as we can. And we also are hosting virtual events. So about once every month, we host a virtual event, and that'll just get you started without having to show up to an event in a particular town. So any of those events are all on our calendar, and you're welcome at any one. You just shoot us an email, and we sign you right up.
That's great. I have one more question I wanted to ask you. I recently read about the outbreak of leptospirosis in the sea lion population, and I'm wondering, does that impact seabirds at all?
Leptospirosis in particular is something that the sea lion population shows a little bit more difficulty with on a regular basis, and I'll say that the marine mammal community is very concerned about that in the stranding procedures. We often do not have our seabirds tested for disease unless there's a particular event going on, like avian influenza, in fact. So we wouldn't necessarily know if one of our seabirds had some viral load similar to leptospirosis in their system at the time that they died. It may have been a contributing factor in some cases, but it's not something that I track in particular with the COAST program. However, disease is certainly a part of seabirds' lives as well, even if it's not that particular disease at this time. So we do keep an eye out for birds, especially on colonies, because that's a lot of the problem with the sea lions as well. When they gather in big groups, they can pass things back and forth. So when seabirds gather on colonies, that's when we're really worried about disease spreading quickly between them. Otherwise, they're out at sea pretty much alone, social distancing, if you will, and they don't transmit disease quite as quickly when they're traveling solo.
Okay, and we all know about social distancing now, so thank you. Jackie, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
You know, I'm just really glad that I could come and chat with you a little bit. We're excited to be able to come back in person and visit folks again on the Oregon coast. We haven't been able to do that in a few years with the regularity that we prefer. So we're very excited to see folks in December, and I hope maybe we'll see some folks listening there too. Thanks so much for having me.
Jackie, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating for me. I know that I do walk the beaches a lot, and when I see a dead bird now, I will definitely think differently about it and maybe even pay a little bit more attention than I do. And hopefully I might even reach out at some point and participate in your training. It's very interesting. So thank you very much.
That's wonderful. We would love to have you all. All beach walkers are welcome, for sure.
Thanks. Have a great day, Jackie.
You too. Thank you so much.
civilized simplicity. Looking up, I see an eagle in flight. Flight that brings me vision. Vision of my ancestors. Ancestors whose wisdom saw life. Life that existed for thousands of years. Thousands of years of civilized simplicity. Civilized simplicity with a place for everyone. Everyone knew their place. Place where nature coincided. Coincided with our necessities. Necessities that required understanding. Understanding one cannot take without giving back. Back so nature can coexist with civilized simplicity. Civilized simplicity now lost forever. Forever as our ancestors watch over us. Through the eagle's flight.
I hope you enjoyed that beautiful poem by Florence, Oregon author and poet Rod Hatter. Music was Drawing Down the Moon by Allison Brown. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door. And thanks to Oregon-based Jumpin' the Rails for performing the theme song, Smith Chapel, used on this show. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.